Welcome to the Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by a slightly larger panel than usual. Once again, we have Miss Amy Claire Morton. Amy Claire, how are you?
Good, thank you.
We have Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you, sir?
Very good, and happy to see that two out of the four panelists have nice art in the background.
Yes, I have a mattress covered in a purple sheet, but let's not talk about that. Miss Saragon. Sarah, how are you today?
No, good, thank you.
Very good. Right, so once again, we have Amy Claire on for a special visit. She's just going to tell us a little bit about the IRR's Stop Citizenship Abuse campaign. This is something we discussed yesterday, and if you want to read more about it, you can check it out on the Daily Friend or on the irr.org.za. It's there on the website. So, Amy Claire, you're going to be doing an interesting and fun trip tomorrow. Is that correct?
Yes. So, Sihle, Big Daddy Liberty, Gabriel and I are going to the Union Buildings, and we're going to deliver our six-page memorandum to the presidency in which we say what citizen abuse is, what government needs to do to stop citizen abuse, and what will happen if they don't. And it'll be interesting to see if we get in, because that would be the best. But yeah, we're going to go and see what happens.
It's going to be an interesting crew arriving there. I think it'll confuse them slightly. That's very good. So was there anywhere else people can read more? France wrote a piece about this, didn't he?
Yes, so that's on the Daily Friend. There was a report an article in the report last Sunday by France, and we will be publishing the memorandum after we've delivered it. And also people can visit our website and sign a submission form to stand with us against citizen abuse.
Awesome stuff. And we'll have you back on Thursday on the last show of the week to tell us about what happened. I'm sure it'll be interesting. And I don't know if Gabriel's scheduled to be on that show, but hopefully he is. And then also we can get his take as well. So we'll hear from the two of you. Anyway, thanks very much, Amy Claire, and we'll see you on Thursday. Go well. Right. So let us get into the main part of the show today. And that is the wild and wacky goings on in South Africa. And of course, the first story that we have today is the controversy around the ANC MP Bongani Bongo, who had a corruption case against him. He was a state security minister, and he was accused of offering a bribe to former parliamentary legal advisor advocate Vana, in an attempt to derail the ESCOM inquiry back in 2017. Now, this went to court, and Western Cape Judge President John Hlophe ruled that the state had failed to produce sufficient evidence, and he dismissed the case. Now, this was pretty controversial. This was on Friday, and it caused former Constitutional Court Justice Johan Krichler to say that there were various deficiencies in the patently dishonest judgment, is the words he used. Krichler is the chairperson of the Freedom Under Law group, and he said that Hlophe did not make an honest evaluation of the evidence. He's a danger on the bench, as we have now seen, he said in an interview to John Mathan from Cape Talk. So, Sarah, let me go to you. Do you think this is – well, firstly, what's the significance of this? And secondly, do you think that this is going to be a serious blow to John Hlophe?
It really rather depends on whether the NPA, the Prosecution Service, takes this decision on appeal. The ANC was very excited about it. You saw lots of press releases about, you know, Bongani Bongo isn't corrupt and the courts have exonerated him and blah, 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 blah. And there's some concern, and other than the forthright nature of Johan Krichler's statements, about the fact that John Hlophe allocated this trial to himself. Because apparently he hasn't done criminal cases for a couple of years. So that in itself is odd. And one has to factor in the fact that he himself faces impeachment as a judge on a very similar charge, and that is trying to persuade, shall I use those words, to constitutional court judges to not to deal harshly with Jacob Zuma, who was still president at the time. This has been going on for about 10 or 12 years. So it's a very similar type of case, very similar type of issue. And both Krikler, who is very outspoken, and a couple of other legal experts have said that there was no reason for finding him not credible. He was the first person witness. There were witnesses that supported his version. But the extraordinary thing that Sharpe did was, a judge can dismiss a case before hearing the accused version if he feels that the prosecution has not presented enough of a case. And that's a decision he made. And he accepted two written statements that Bongani Bongo had submitted on the issue, but because of this, he was not subjected to cross-examination or being forced to give his version in court under oath. And that, frankly, is just extraordinary. I mean, if you read anything about it, Sharpe seemed to really try to find ways to get rid of this case by hearing it and then by not hearing it. The fact that Varana didn't know that Bongani Bongo was an advocate. I mean, what relevance that has to anything, I have absolutely no idea. And the second thing was that Varana had reported it to Parliament, who then, at a later stage, the DA laid a charge, rather than directly laying a charge against him at a police station. Again, sort of, so what? You know, he's trying to imply that Varana didn't see this as important. And one can't help thinking that this is a real miscarriage of justice. If they do take on an appeal, and if the appeal court finds in favor of the prosecution, it means that the case would have to be reheard. A decision wouldn't be made for or against Bongo. It would be reheard. But it's absolutely extraordinary, particularly given the trouble that Sharpe is in, which includes another set of impeachment proceedings over abuse, attacking his deputy, threatening her. I mean, it doesn't get more South African than that.
Indeed. Yeah, I must say, Gabriel, this looks really bad. It looks like someone who's in a political faction with another person decides basically to bail him out when it came time to trial. Is that too harsh?
On the face of it, no. It's, you know, as Sarah said, there just are rules and regulations about how judges are supposed to go about dismissing cases, and he didn't follow them. So there, and there's also these two other cases of impeachment standing against Judge Sharpe. I think it's a hard point to drive home to South Africans, but we all appreciate that our parliament does not always represent the best interests of the country. Our parliament stood by and defended Jacob Zuma to the ends of the earth against a few insiders who were trying to short circuit his presidency and his ability to use a patronage network to take our money, our taxpayers' contributions, and feather his cronies' nest. We all know that the police include some very brave men and women, but that there are many corrupt people in blue who will take bribes and turn the other way and be too cowardly to really deal with criminals where they come along, but will very eagerly sort of parade up and down the beaches and check out who's in a bikini. We all know that corporate South Africa is full of appeasniks who will, bend over backwards until they are fully supine in order to make friends with St. Cyril and company. But most of us still hold on to this lingering belief that the courts are an impartial and courageous organ of state, that if you make it to court, if you've got the resources to lawyer up and get yourself there, you will face an impartial judge who will uphold the rule of law and that if you're not guilty, you will be found as such. And if you are guilty, you're going to be put behind bars. Yeah, there are several cases that speak to this, but I think none with a judge quite so prominently compromised on the available evidence as Judge Schlope. And I think that's a sort of lingering point that Sara makes, is that it's not just that he did this outrageous thing, which would be outrageous if any judge did it. It's that he's already in this position of scandal and degradation of the office that he occupies, and still went forward with it. He obviously has it in mind that his status is so high and that South Africans' trust in the courts is so great that politically the pressure is going to be insufficient to drive the prosecuting authority to reopen this case and get a retrial, which would, if it goes through, as far as we can tell.
Ah, we appear to have vacuuming or something in the background.
Oh, sorry. I'll see if I can,
this is so. This is it, right? You know, this is what Klopp is hoping for. Never mind the facts, never mind what's really going on in the ground. Some vacuum noise from out of space is going to suck the facts right from under your nose, and you won't have to worry about it. We can continue.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it is good, though, to see that there is a justice, in this case, Johan Krikler, as a former senior part of the judiciary, kind of coming out and saying very harsh words about what's gone on here. And it's because that to me speaks of the sort of institutions, South African institutions, a lot of them are not very strong, but that is something. There's something to be said that there is a part of an institution coming through to defend what is good and what is right. Sorry, your final thoughts on this before we move on?
Just to pick up on something Gabriel said, and that's the fact that we're in a very heightened state of aggravation. I mean, our hashtag citizen abuse speaks to that. But the fact that given the crisis, the crisis of legitimacy that the government is facing, it's the third arm of governance, the judiciary, the fact that somebody as compromised as Schlope felt in the circumstances that he could hear the matter and decide this way is truly frightening.
Indeed. Before we move on, I'd like to say, Gabriel, that I see one of our commenters suggested that you might be enjoying a Zol there. I'll leave that to you to decide how to deal with. Let's move on to our next topic. And this is Regulation 28. So this is Regulation 28 of the Pension Fund Act. And the South African government is plans to change it. They want to. So currently, the regulation puts limits on where pooled retirement money can be invested by retirement funds. So, for example, you can't put more than 75% of your fund in shares. It also limits how much these funds can put overseas. But the government wants to change it so that now retirement funds will be able to invest 45% of the money they manage into South African infrastructure. They'll be able to put another 10% to African infrastructure outside of South Africa. So you might be able to put 55% of your or the fund will be able to put 55% of its investments in infrastructure. So one of the important things here is that this isn't an obligation, which is quite important. And that is something I think we were very concerned about, that there was going to be a straight-up prescription to invest in Eskom or something like that. So, Gabriel, you've talked a lot about the prescribed assets issue in the past. What's your take on this? Is this a victory? Is this not a victory? Where should we stand on this?
Yeah, so I think this is a victory for the IRR in the sense that prescribing assets is not what's taken place. And it's in black and white if you read the NEDLAC discussion document that came out of the conference that elected Cyril Ramaphosa to be president of the party in 2017. The ANC wanted to push for prescribing assets. If you listen to the statements of Ibrahim Patel and other members of cabinet, you will find that ANC has pushed for prescribed assets. They haven't gotten it. They haven't gotten it. Okay, you could say for the simple reason that it doesn't make sense as a thing to do, but you'd have to be living on another planet.
That hasn't stopped government recently at all.
They haven't gotten it because of a concerted pushback coming from especially the Institute. But in this case, we have managed to get big business on side. We have managed, most importantly, to get ordinary pensioners on side to apply pressure to the fund managers that hold their stock of wealth and say, what are you doing to make sure that this doesn't go through? And that in turn resulted in pressure going through to government. So in that sense, a win. But in another sense, not necessarily a win. One thing to note is that the 45% infrastructure cap should probably be read as probative rather than as genuinely limiting. We don't have a number for the percentage of pension fund assets that are invested in infrastructure, and this pension pot is in the trillions of rands, because there's been no legal requirement to do so, and so there's no collated infrastructure spend coming out of all asset managing groups. What they will now have to do is provide such a number. We will know this time next year what percentage of South African savings, pension savings, are invested in infrastructure. In some cases, it might be more than 45%, and then there's going to be the perverse result that they're going to be forced to reduce their infrastructure overhead. In other cases, it'll be less than 45, and they might be able to bring it up. That then, in turn, might provide the government for a rationale to say, look, we've set it at 45%. We said it as a ceiling, but it turns out that three of the big pension funds are only investing 10% in the infrastructure, and so we would like them to change that.
So this is turning into a stepping stone rather than being going for the end prize in the first move.
Correct. And the other thing to note is that the real regulatory – so the infrastructure shift is really just an evidentiary one because it's a newly defined asset class within Regulation 28, which manages pension funds. Where there has been a shift in the cap, it's been in private equities, hedge funds, and other assets that are similarly classed. And there the cap was, it's a bit more complicated than this, but the cap for that group was 15%. Pension fund couldn't hold more than 15% in this kind of thing. And that has effectively been shifted to 25%, even slightly more, depending on how you read it. And what matters about that is that a pension fund is usually not in a position to, a private equity deal basically means you own part of a project that is not publicly listed. So you really are a co-owner. You sit at the little table and you say, what are we going to do with this? And who are we going to buy from? And where are we going to put it? And so on and so forth. Venture capital, private equity funds, these guys are sometimes called angel funders. They're the most involved, typically, asset managers in finance, because they're not sort of saying to a board of directors, here's a bit of money and you do with it what you think is right, and we're going to invest this money in you on the basis of past performance, or buying a stock or a bond, which is just, you know, you can, if you buy a stock, go and sit at the annual general meeting, but you really have a very backseat role. Usually it makes sense for pension funds to take that backseat role so that they can spend their time choosing the best assets rather than running those assets. So there's something appealing about shifting this cap from 15% to 25%, because it means they can be more active investors. They can get involved with infrastructure projects and say, look, this is not making sense. You need to do things differently. But on the flip side, it means that they're going to have more discretionary power. So if you have a pension fund whose managers are in cahoots or in family or in whatever with some developer who says, look, I'll build a bridge or a dam or a hotel or whatever it is for X amount of money. And by the way, if you give me the tender or the contract rather than someone else, there's a very nice swimming pool coming your way. that's now more possible than it was before. I'm just highlighting this because it's not something that's been given much play in the business analysis of what's going on there. But this is South Africa is not the first country to be sitting in this position where the fiscal cupboard is so empty and unemployment is high. I mean, it's almost never as high as we have it, but where you've got that combination of a bankrupt government and an unemployed workforce, where the thought is what we need is new investment in order to get the gears going, and let's turn to pensioners to do that. And the classic problem that you find in such a situation is backroom kickback dealing, corporate mismanagement, transpiring as a result of increased discretionary and active investment by pension fund managers, whose primary responsibility and best practice way of going about things is usually in this passive asset selection role rather than in the active management role.
Sorry, your thoughts on the changes to Regulation 28?
Well, yeah. I mean, theoretically, the infrastructure investment option or the increased option, what worries me, of course, is it may well be an attractive option for a pension fund because theoretically you've got government guarantees behind it. But the problem is we've got a government without money. We wouldn't, I don't think anyone would trust. And I think as a trustee of a pension fund who has an obligation to the members to invest wisely and appropriately, I'm not sure it'll be a very long time before much looks wise or appropriate. That's probably my concern. And also because you've got this problem and because you've got the wastage and the fact that the cupboard is bare, I think the temptation to take it from the you may invest to you will invest is likely to become very, very attractive. It's desperation because, I mean, it's like, you know, okay, the creditors of SAA have the guarantees from the government and look where we are with SAA. I mean, it's moribund.
Right.
We'll just have more moribund.
If I can add to that. So one of the most important caps that that regulation imposes is the extent to which any particular fund can invest in any particular project. Mm. And if you sort of look at the reading coming out of financial journalists for the last 2 years in the debate over Eskom and its debt crisis, part of the discovery has been that many pension funds are already overinvested in Eskom, mm. Already above the legal limit. So how do you keep funneling money into an uncompetitive economy that's constrained by rubbish red tape and BE and all kinds of silliness that's anti-competitive at the same time as nominally respecting the rule of law? Mm. And one thing that you can do is you say, well, we're not going to invest any more in Eskom directly, but we'll invest in a separate infrastructure project, which we'll be privately managing, which is going to be building the new rail tracks that are needed to get coal to plant, or the new storage facility that's going to make it the case that when it rains, we don't all lose electricity like they used to in the 1400s, you know, when peats got rained on, then suddenly. So the devil's in the details. I've been poring over the actual shift in the recommended shifts in the regulations. We're going to have until the end of March to look further into it for finer details. But the point is that unfortunately, even laws that are somewhat well-intentioned can become the precondition for malpractice if the administrative bodies executing those laws, both from a prosecutorial point of view and from a corporate governance point of view, are not doing their part. And that's what turns any victory into something of a draw. Unless you have genuine reform pushing against that, you end up just aiding and abetting this patronage network system.
Right. As far as I'm concerned, a draw is good news, considering the way that government has been going in the last couple of years. So I think that this is pretty good news that whatever may be coming down the tracks, at least we don't have prescribed assets today. And I think that's a good thing. Right. So let's go to our last story. And I mean, I'm probably not giving too much away by telling you what I wrote in my notes to describe this item. I just said stupid race thing reporter masks. Now, that's perhaps suggesting that I'm not going to give this a very fair hearing. But Gabriel, you're a wise man of much benevolence, far more than I have. Tell us about the latest race row attacking ENCA.
So journalist Lindsay Detlinger of ENCA has been accused of racism on the basis of a short YouTube montage created by someone who I don't know, in which she interviews six members of parliament, and three of them are white, and she doesn't ask them to wear a mask, and they're not wearing a mask, and three of them are black. And they sort of arrive wearing masks, and she says, no, please keep your mask on. One arrives with a mask in his hand and says, please put it on. And so there seems to be this pattern of treating black people according to one standard, namely, you know, the rule of law, and white people according to another standard, namely, you guys can just speak without a mask. I did see some of these interviews live on ENCA, and I worried about what was going on. To be clear, Detlinger's defense is that she was not racially motivated at all, that as a result of coronavirus, they haven't had the kind of producer support that they used to. So usually there's a producer standing outside parliament after the budget speech, after Sona, after any big event, and the producer will then line up the interviews with the parliamentarians, prep them for that, and then slot them in as they're doing the live broadcast straight after you've sort of been forced to watch the president for 2 hours. But without those producers, people have just been arriving. So someone arrived with no mask at all. John Steenhuisen's his mask's not in the vicinity, and you're live on air. What are you going to do? You just go forward with the questions. Then the next guy arrives, he is wearing his mask, and he starts taking it off to be like, John, you say, no, actually it's better if you wear your mask. So her argument is that it is the constraints of the circumstance that produced these outcomes, and that there were contingencies that are not racially based, and that she had no malintent, and she's personally apologized to all of the people she asked to wear a mask, which in my opinion is absurd. You shouldn't apologize for asking someone to wear a mask where the law requires it. But ENCA has said, you know, we're investigating this. We don't think our journalist's racist, but we do think she broke company policy. You're supposed to sort of just ask everyone to wear a mask, and she didn't do that. So, you know, and she's apologized for doing that. But the upshot is a lot of political hay for those running our country into the ground, much like Qebecha, the renaming of Port Elizabeth.
There were three parties that seem to have gotten involved here. It was the EFF, the ANC, and the IFP. Is that correct?
That's right. And there's sort of toying outside of ENCA right now, is my understanding, or there was slightly earlier today. And I mean, I just think that there's so many things, there's so many problems with this, but the simplest one is just that, I'll say two. One is that Detlinger has said, you know, these people also have some kind of bias because they're attributing this to me, racism, because they think I'm white. Now, she hasn't identified as white. She's also not identified as not white. And if you really want to flip and get in the mindset of an old gnat, go and look up Lindsay Detlinger, look at her face, and try and figure out her race. Because like many people who hail from the Western Cape, it's not exactly obvious. But that assumption has been made. White racist, all of her detractors have painted her in those terms. And the second, it's a small little thing, but it's an interesting thing to think about how twisted the mentality is. And the second thing is that there's no evidence anywhere in her reporting or her journalistic career over the last 20 years that she has materially altered facts, that she's acted in any disparaging way towards people on the basis of their race. All that you have is three interviews where she's asked some people to wear masks. And if they, you know, insofar as there's a problem there at all, that seems like good news. There's a small enough problem that you can solve it. And all of her detractors paint this as that large and insoluble problem that's extended for thousands of years, where black people are considered vectors of disease and this problem is never going to go away. And that solutions-oriented attitude versus that sort of chosen trauma, things are always terrible attitude has shone up in stark contrast. And I think that it's worth just noticing that contrast so that you can figure out how to stand more with a solution oriented way of thinking and outside of this framework where we're all damned forever because one woman asked one black person to wear a mask.
Sarah, your thoughts on eternal damnation and solution orientation?
Yeah. Never apologize. It's in the world of woke, it's only going to dig you deeper. But what worries me here is it's not adult. I mean, I would have thought if there was a perception by someone in the ANC that this had happened, the adult way to deal with it was to communicate with someone senior at the ANC, write an email or whatever and say, this is our concern, this is becoming apparent. I think you need to rein your employee in. By all accounts, that didn't happen. It just got put onto the internet and out it went. And excuse me. And what you have is that sort of deliberately taking what may or may not be an issue and making it an issue by virtue of publicizing it. It's like a lot of the sort of very big cases we had of alleged of hate speech and et cetera, in the last from 2016 onwards. It's a bit like what people say and think in private. Generally, you can't control. But as soon as someone gets it out into the public, it can be turned into a cause célèbre, and that's what they've done. I heard the police helicopters in the area, and I thought, good God in heaven, we haven't got the money for this sort of action where police have to monitor this sort of process. Where are the adults in the room? And they clearly were not amongst the political parties that protested.
Right.
That's not just a comment on the actual substance of the issue at all, but just on the process.
It sounds a lot like the sort of emotional impact of this thing was created through editing. Is that fair, Gabriel, to say that?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I can't be 100% sure, but I have I have gone back and looked through some of her work on Muckrack, which is a sort of site that traces these things over many, many years. And she just seems like a really decent journalist. So it's hard to make sense of this without that editorial lens that you speak to. But as I say, I mean, do some investigation. If she's got problems, then try and figure them out. Try and rehabilitate your employee. You know, she's got great experience, and we need more good journalists. I'm very much of the view that when people err, they're to be corrected, they're not to be permanently thrown under the bus.
Right. Now, what disturbs me is the sort of microscopic view of like personal interactions that's being done through cameras and through the internet. Just, it feels like exactly the right way to make sure that nothing good ever comes from this.
If there's one anecdote that it sort of reminds me of, it's when the South African Springbok team was in Japan and we scored a try or something, and then one of the white guys hugged one of the white guys and didn't hug the black guy, and then everyone screamed racist, and the black guy was like, no, I wasn't part of the subunit that did the move that scored the try. They were doing a little subunit thing organized by the coach. This is not racist at all. And that kind of,
right,
we're very early on the trigger here.
But yeah, if you're looking for signs of something, you're going to find it. Sometimes you'll find what you're looking for, and sometimes you'll just be drawing dots in the sky to make constellations. Anyway. I think that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. Please check out thedailyfriend.co.za for news and opinion and analysis and all that good stuff. Gabriel's just written a great piece, which I think has gone up in Media 24. Gabriel, what's the title of that?
Yeah, News 24 is Discovery Sincere in its Drive for Social Solidarity. Basically, the question we ask is how Adrian Gore dare say that it's impossible for Discovery to accelerate the speed of vaccination in this country when the facts so firmly contradict that position. They are in every position to accelerate the vaccination in South Africa by supplying vaccines to their clients, which is their duty. And so go check it out. News 24 is Discovery Sincere.
Awesome stuff. All right. Thank you very much for listening. And we'll catch you tomorrow on the next episode of The Daily Fringe Show. Cheers, everyone.